Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Soul to Soul. Today we're going to be looking at a very interesting topic. I think something that most of us South African Jews will be fascinated by. And that is the history of Lithuanian Jewry. We as South Africans, over 90% of our community has its roots in Lithuania. That's where our ancestors come from. And so I think it is very worthwhile having a look at what made Lithuanian Jewry unique, what their unique characteristics were and are, and certainly are continue to be reflected within the characteristics of our wonderful South African Jewish community. So stay with me until the hour ends, until 2 o'clock, and we will explore some fascinating history about the Jewry of Lithuania and its tremendous impact on our South African Jewish community. The Jews in Europe already started arriving, inhabiting different communities in Europe from the Roman times. The Jews came to France, to Spain, to Germany with the Roman legions, and they continued to live, Jews continued to live in European countries, both East and West European countries, right up until the Holocaust. So until they were destroyed, they were annihilated in the Holocaust. So we're talking between 1600 and 1700 years, Jews were living in Europe. And being Europe is a large place, and the Jews were spread right across the continent, Western Europe, Central Europe. Western Europe is Spain, France, Germany, Eastern Europe, Lithuania, Poland, Central Europe, Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia. So Jews were in all of these places. And as a result of a long time being in the place and at such a large area, so obviously Jews began to pick up different characteristics of those places that they were in. And that had an impact on those Jewish communities. So since we are from Lithuania, let's explore the history of the Jews in Lithuania. We'll focus mainly on the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. The reason why I'm choosing to do this is because I'm leading a trip to Poland and Lithuania with Rabbi Pesach Kron, which is a great opportunity and something that is very worthwhile. We'll be going from the 13th to the 20th of August. So it's in just over 3 weeks' time, and there's a wonderful group of people going. There are still some places left on the trip, so if anybody is interested in joining us to Poland and Lithuania with the legendary Rabbi Kron, you can send me an email on rabbidrs@gmail.com, rabbidrs@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to answer your queries. So with going to Poland, Lithuania, obviously it's something that's fascinating and worthwhile having an understanding of the history and the overview of the Jews of Lithuania. And that's why I've been researching a little bit into the subject. Most of my research comes from Rabbi Beryl Wine, who is a great historian and has a very comprehensive understanding of the history of Jewish communities around the world. So let's look at Lithuania. Lithuania is on the Baltic between Germany, which was up until Germany was Prussia, and Russia on the other side. Lithuania is a Roman Catholic country. It didn't adopt the Protestant religion of Germany or the Russian Orthodox Church of Russia, but it is almost entirely Roman Catholic, like Poland as well. Lithuania has almost no natural resources, very poor country. The only abundance in Lithuania is really timber and fish and not much else. It's certainly not a major economic player. Lithuania has a terrible climate, very cold long winters and short hot summers. There's a lot of marshes over there. It's not a very hospitable place to be. The Jews came very early from many places to that part of the world. There was quite a large influx after the Spanish expulsion. We do know that there was a lot of movement of the Jewish world in the 10th and 11th centuries after the centrality of Babel began to wane. Babylonia, the Jews were exiled from the land of Israel by the Romans, and they were, the Byzantine Christians were quite anti-Semitic and virulent in their attempts to convert the Jews. So the Jews weren't able to be in Eretz Israel. They ended up, most of the Jewish community ended up being in Babylonian Babel, which is Iran and Iraq today. And they were there for about 800 years. And then by the end of the millennia, the year 1000, Jews began to leave en masse from that area and explore other places that offered great opportunity, because economically things began to be difficult in the Middle East. And so they went to North Africa, they crossed the Mediterranean and went into Europe, and many, a large community also went to Spain, and that's how the Spanish Jewish community began to grow. So some had already been in the European countries, as we mentioned, from the Roman Legion, and many more came at this time, at the in the year 1000 and round about that time, and many went at that time also to Spain. But with the Spanish Inquisition in 1492, so it became a very difficult, obviously, most of the Jews of Spain were given the very difficult choice of either converting or leaving. About half of the community left and the other half converted, and that's where we had the Muranos, the conversos, who they were pretending to be Christians on the outside, but were really practiced Judaism privately, and that's what the Inquisition was about, to expose these people. So the many that left actually went to Europe and went further east and ended up in Poland and Lithuania. So it's very interesting. We know the Torah Tamima, Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, who was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, who was Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein. So he writes in his autobiography, Makor Baruch, he says that his family is actually Sfardi, and their real name is Ben Benisti. And on the way to Lithuania, leaving Spain, they stopped over in the German city of Epstein, and that's why they changed their names to Epstein. And he says, any Ashkenazi who is a Levi and whose name is Epstein is really a Sfardi. And that was important. The influence of the Sfardi Jews was significant to Lithuanian Jewry, because the Sfardi Jews were much broader than the Ashkenazi Jews. They had a broader worldview, and they were a lot more moderate in many different areas. And so that also had a great impact on the Jews in Lithuania. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
We're looking at the fascinating history of Lithuanian Jewry, the heritage of most of us South African Jews. And we've been discussing the build-up of the Jewish community in Lithuania, which already started from the Roman Legion and increased with the Spanish Inquisition. And it even became larger. The real sizable influx of Jews happened in the 15th century after the Black Death, the bubonic plague. The bubonic plague was in Western Europe, and it was a terrible plague that killed millions of people. One-third of the Western European population was wiped out by the Black Death. And unfortunately, Jews were very often blamed for it. One of the reasons is because the incidence of death within the Jewish community was far less than in the non-Jewish community, largely because in those times they didn't know about bacteria, and they didn't know about hygiene and the spread of the disease. The Jews didn't know either, but as a part of halacha, washing one's hands and being clean is a basic requirement within Jewish practice and Jewish life. We wash our hands before we pray. We wash our hands before we eat. We wash our hands after we eat. So as a result of that, we wash our hands after going to the bathroom. As a result of those being a part of the cycle of the pattern of Jewish life, so the spread of the bubonic plague was far less in the Jewish community. And as a result, Jews were they were very suspicious of the Jews and thought that the Jews were practicing these dark magic curses and were poisoning the wells. And there were widespread pogroms throughout Western Europe, particularly in Germany. And so the Jews were faced terrible persecution. And many of those Jews left, and they went further east, and many of them settled in Lithuania. So that's where the community, from being a very small, insignificant one, picked up its numbers and became far more significant in terms of its size. Lithuania at the time was a large empire. It was controlled, it controlled what are large parts of Poland today. And as a result, there was economic opportunity which attracted the Jews to that region. The Jews lived in very small towns, what we call shtetelach, the little, small little villages and towns. Usually there were 30 or 40 Jewish families, and those families supported the entire Jewish infrastructure of the town. And that usually included the employment of a rabbi. Often we see these small towns had very great rabbonim, being the rov of that little town. Sometimes the great rabbonim purposefully wanted to be in small towns because it gave them time to learn, it gave them time to grow in terms of their own learning, rather than being burdened with being the rov of a shul with 500 families, which would take a tremendous amount of time, and the rov then wouldn't have time to further his own development and growth spiritually. So the basis of Lithuanian Jewry was always Torah. Torah is always the center of the life of the Lithuanian Jew. And it's the Lithuanian approach was always a very intellectual approach, a very intellectual Jewry. And it wasn't unlike the spiritual kind of bent that Polish Jewry had, which please God we'll have a chance to discuss as well. Lithuanian Jewry was very simple. It was a direct relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Torah was always the center of the life of a Jew, and there were almost no illiterate Jews in Lithuania. Every Jew learned, even if they were involved in commerce, in industry, in having, you know, whatever, they had a shop or a merchant. Every Jew learned every day, and the center of their world was the Beis Midrash, was the Beis Knesset, was the shul. A individual by the name of Avraham Kariv wrote a wonderful essay called Lita Mukurasi, which is means my Lithuania. And he describes over there the life in Lithuania so clearly and so beautifully. And he says that the life really was unchanged for over three centuries. And people worked very hard. There was a lot of poverty. But the connection to Torah was always very strong. There was a very little relationship with the non-Jewish world. Many Lithuanians, Lithuanian Jews didn't speak Lithuanian. They had minimal contact with the non-Jewish society, perhaps in the marketplace where they sold their wares. There wasn't an attraction and a pull to be a part of non-Jewish Lithuanian society, which is very different to how it was in Hungary and how it was in Germany. And it's actually quite similar here in South Africa also. There wasn't a great attraction to assimilate into non-Jewish. At least that was in the 20th century. Things have certainly changed in the 21st century. And the focus of the life of a Lithuanian Jew was the shul, was the Beis Midrash. There was also the source of entertainment as well. There were famous magidim. Magidim were these professional speakers who spoke and went from town to town. That was their parnosa. The rov, the rabbi of the town, wasn't necessarily an orator and didn't speak publicly very often. Usually the rov spoke twice a year on Shabbos Haggadol and Shabbos Shuvah. And often those talks were not very user-friendly. Usually they were very long. They were 2 hours or more. It was always a deep halachic analysis. And most of the time, by the time he reached the end, very few people were with him. There's a famous story of Rav Isaac Harif of Slonim, and he was employed as the rabbi. And he had a great skill of explaining complicated ideas in a very clear and simple way. In his inaugural speech, which also dragged on for almost 2 hours, people came up to him afterwards and said, "We don't know if you could be the rabbi of our town." And he said, "Why not?" He says, "Because everybody understood what you were saying. And a real rabbi, people don't understand what they're saying." So that was usually the style in Lithuania. But the Magid was a great entertainer. The Magid was an excellent speaker. He was a very dramatic, you know, performer. When the Magid came to town, the shops would close, the schools would close, everybody would go listen to him. He would make the people laugh, he would make the people cry, and obviously his focus was inspiring the people to greater heights of Torah observance, of mitzvah observance, of limud ha-Torah. Today we see, interestingly, that the position of a rabbi has changed. The rav does it all. In Lita, it was all compartmentalized. You had experts in different areas. You had your magid, who was your great speaker. You had your av beis din, who was the poisek. You had your rov, who would teach Torah to the people of the town. Today the rabbi does all three in one. A famous example is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the great Talmud Chacham who was the Rav of the town of Brisk. And he wouldn't paskin shilas in his town, despite being a huge Talmud Chacham. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Simcha Zissel was the Poisek of the town, which was often the model in Lithuania. We even see with the great Chofetz Chaim that he and the Chofetz Chaim never held an official position. So he wasn't the Rav of the town of Radin where he was from. He wasn't even the Rosh Yeshiva, although he had a yeshiva. His son-in-law was the Rosh Yeshiva. The rabbi of the town was Rabbi Kopstein. And imagine having the Chofetz Chaim as one of your balabatim in your community. It couldn't be a very simple thing. But that generally was the style and the situation of the setup of communities in Lithuania. The Lithuanian Jews appeared to be a little bit reserved and cold. You know, we have the phrase a kalta litvak, like a cold litvak. But that was only on the outside. On the inside, Lithuanian Jews were very warm, very kind people, very emotional people, very spiritual people, connected to a powerful spiritual legacy that their lives were devoted to. And that legacy has continued for many generations. There's a famous anecdote that a Litvak went to Poland and he went into a shtibel, a Hasidic shtibel, and for davening, the people were screaming and shouting. And afterwards, he went to the Gabbai and he said, maybe you should try asking nicely first. So that captures almost the different approach of the Lithuanian Jews being quite reserved and gentle, but underneath that surface, burning with a real fire of Torah. The Lithuanian Jewry was, as I mentioned, very intellectual, but they were also a very tolerant group, probably the most tolerant in Europe. There were many great disputes that we saw in the 17th and 18th centuries in the Jewish communities in Poland and in Hungary. But these disputes didn't really reach Lithuania because there wasn't the nature of the Lithuanian Jew. They were quite tolerant and broad-minded of others' views. I heard this from Rabbi Wine. He said he heard it from one of the great Hungarian rebbes. And the rebbe said that the way the Jewish world looks today is as a result of the history of the Jewish people. We know that tragically over 90% of Lithuanian Jewry was destroyed in the Holocaust, was murdered by the Nazis, by the Einsatzgruppen. So very little remained of the Lithuanian Jews that were still there. Those that obviously had left and many had come to South Africa and many had gone to other parts of the world, they survived, but of the Jews in Lithuania, over 90% were destroyed. And the Lithuanians were the most moderate of all the Jews of Europe. And as a result, we see that the Jewish world today, for example, Hungarian Jewry, 40% of Hungarian Jewry survived the war. So the Hungarians were far more extreme, both on the religious side and on the secular side. So that extremism has really followed on and remained in our world today. And it reflects the destruction of Lithuanian Jewry. There was strong opposition to Hasidism, to the Hasidic movement that was led by the Gaon of Vilna, the great leader of Lithuanian Jewry, in the 18th century. The Gaon, and that's the reason why the only place in Eastern Europe where the Hasidic movement didn't take over was in Lithuania. The Lithuanians had their own form of Hasidus, which actually was the Musa movement. I don't think we're going to have time today to discuss the Musa movement. Please God, next week we'll discuss what that was and how that really was, just as there was a great revolution in the rest of Eastern Europe through the Hasidic movement, there was a great revolution in Lithuania as well through the Musa movement. But that opposition to Hasidism didn't last so long. In other words, already Rav Chaim Volozhin wrote his Nefesh HaChaim, which was a answer to Hasidism on a Kabbalistic level. But soon, it didn't last very long because already his son, Rav Yitzchak of Volozhin, worked very closely with the Tzemach Tzedek, with the Third Lubavitcher Rebbe, on behalf of Jews in Russia, on behalf of the rights of Jews in Russia. And so that fervent opposition didn't carry on for very long. Even though there was the general attitude and character of Lithuanian Jews were they were quite broad and laid back and tolerant of all others. We see a similar approach happened with regards to Haskalah. Haskalah was the movement of enlightenment. It was a secular movement, a revolution, and a departure from tradition. It gained ground in terms of ideas all over Europe, both Western and Eastern Europe, but it didn't impact on the practice of Lithuanian Jews as much as it did on the practice of Jews in other parts of Europe. Because Lithuanian Jews were a more open religious society. They had a broader view, and the Jewish people, they listened to those ideas of the Haskalah, and in some sense they incorporated them, which made the opposition less virulent and fervent. We see also that the Zionist movement, when the Zionist movement began, it spread far and wide in Lita. And Lita was the birthplace of religious Zionism. Rav Reines was in Lida. Rav Kook was a Talmud of Volozhin. He was the Rav in Boisk. And they were the ones that started and spread religious Zionism. And since the Jews of Lithuania were quite broad, even though the Zionist movement was primarily a secular movement, but still nonetheless it was accepted in Lithuania, and the birth of religious Zionism took place. Most of the Rabbonim in Lithuania were members of or supported Mizrahi, which was the religious Zionist movement. Certainly the crown, the jewel in the crown of Lithuanian Jewry was the Yeshiva movement. The Yeshiva movement transformed the Jewish world, and it was a Lithuanian invention. The Yeshiva movement started in 1803 by Reb Chaim Volozhin. In 1813, Reb Chaim Volozhin opened the Volozhin Yeshiva. Reb Chaim was a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, and the Gaon had already expressed to Reb Chaim a thought, and he projected into the future and said there would be an important need with regards to the future of Torah within Klal Yisrael to build Torah institutions that would be responsible for educating the next generation. Reb Chaim took this on, and so by 1813 he opened the first yeshiva in the world called the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he wrote a letter to all the rabbis of Lithuania, and he said to them, the Torah is being forgotten. We're not succeeding in passing on the Torah to the next generation. The main reason for that at that time, why it was so desperate, it was just after the Napoleonic Wars, and Napoleon had invaded Russia in 1812, and his army spread through all of the Jewish areas, and Napoleon was defeated by the great Russian winter, and by the time Napoleon left, the Jewish communities in Eastern Europe suffered tremendous losses, both in terms of people and in terms of infrastructure. So that, of course, had a major impact on Lithuanian Jewry, and Rav Chaim wrote that, you know, we don't have any books, we don't have any means to teach, we need to make an institution that will create great scholars for the Jewish people and will build Torah again in Lita and ensure that the Torah remains alive for future generations. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sachstein on 101.9 High FM.
We're talking about the jewel in the crown of Lithuanian Jewry, which was the start of the Yeshiva movement. And the Vilna Gaon already directed his Talmud, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, to open up a educational institution for Torah to ensure that there would be great Jewish leaders in the coming generations. And Rav Chaim Volozhin started the attempts to do so in 1803. By 1813, Rav Chaim opened the Volozhin Yeshiva and he encouraged all of the Rabbonim around Lithuania to send their best scholars to come and study in the yeshiva. Volozhin, the town of Volozhin, is actually quite a small town. But there were around about 100, 120 families, the same size as my community, Sunny Road Kehillah, which you know, that's not a large amount of Jews that would have to support this institution. You know, when we look at great Jewish centers of the world, we look at Lakewood, which Bli Ahara is close to 100,000 Jews. Bnei Brak is close to 200,000 Jews. Kain Yirbu. So Volozhin was very small, and it wasn't easy for them to be able to support the yeshiva on their own. And so Reb Chaim had to look beyond just their town in order to support the yeshiva. And he did so successfully. He organized the curriculum. The students would study for 7.5 years. They would finish all of Shas, the entire Talmud. They would start with Brachos and finish with Nida. And not like today where the cycle of learning in yeshiva is usually 6 or 7 masechtas. And they certainly appealed to the elite of the intellectuals of the Jewish community of Lithuania. At its heart, the Volozhin yeshiva was 350 students. On average, there were about 200 students in the yeshiva. They had no dormitories, so there were no meals provided by the yeshiva. In order for a student to study in the yeshiva, he had to rent a room from a local family, and he had to pay that family for the meals that he would have. So some students could afford that on their own and make the payments, but others couldn't afford it, and the yeshiva would then have to help them with those payments. So that was the expense of the yeshiva. The only other expense of the yeshiva was, of course, paying the staff, paying the rabbonim. So how did they raise the money for the yeshiva? So Reb Chaim came up with a very big innovation that hadn't been seen before, and he now sent out collectors to all over Lithuania and the rest of the Jewish world, and those collectors were entitled to a commission. As long as most of the money went to the yeshiva, he allowed them to take a commission, and that is one of the ways that they supported the yeshiva. Another way is that they admitted students who came from towns that supported the yeshiva. So if there were larger Jewish towns that contributed, and the members of those towns contributed generously to the yeshiva would then admit students that came from that town. Rabbi Wan talks of his grandfather, who was a student who went to Volozhin Yeshiva, and his grandfather's family, when his grandfather was 10 years old, moved from the small town that they were in to a larger town that was a supporter of the yeshiva, so he would be accepted in the yeshiva. At the age of 13, he was accepted because he came from that town. If he stayed in that little town, he would never have been accepted. There's a famous incident where a collector was very well dressed, and he came in a fancy carriage to collect money for the yeshiva. And the person he was collecting from wrote a letter to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And he said to Reb Chaim that, you know, the collector on behalf of the yeshiva came in this fancy carriage, and I want the contribution that I made, I want to go entirely to Torah and not to this guy's carriage. And Reb Chaim answered him, and he said that when it came to the Mishkan, to the sanctuary, so everybody wanted, and people, the Jewish community, the Jews in the desert, contributed their gold for the building of the sanctuary of the Mishkan. And everybody wanted their gold to be used for the Aron HaKadosh, or to be used for the Kruvim, for those angels that were carved in gold on the Kaporis, on top of the Aron. He said, but they also needed gold for other parts of the Mishkan. So how did Bezalel decide which gold should go where? So the pasuk says, "Kol isha shed nidve libo." Anybody who gives of their heart, that if somebody intended to give 100% lishmo, for the sake of heaven, and they didn't have any ulterior motives, like for their own kavod, their honor that they gave, or because they want to be rewarded in olam haba, so those people, individuals that contributed, their gold would be used entirely for the Aaron. But those who had ulterior motives, their gold would be used in other places. Hashem directed it in that way. So he says, if you were 100% L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of heaven, in your contribution to the yeshiva, so then your money would be used entirely for Torah. But if you had other agenda mixed in, it would be used for other needs, for the horse and the carriage, which is also needed. So that was quite an innovation, to be able to collect from other communities and to ensure that other communities should support the yeshiva. Today we take it for granted. Today we contribute to Jewish causes, to yeshivas, which is obviously a great cause, the highest level of priority in tzedakah, apart from one's family, to contribute and give to the learning of Torah, which is the future of the Jewish people. Makes sense, because that's how the Jewish people will remain connected and vibrant and alive and pass on to the next generation. So, but today we don't only give to Jewish causes, to yeshivas and to the study of Torah in our city, which of course we should do. We do so to all over the world, and especially to Eretz Yisrael. Rightly so, but we take it for granted today. It really, that idea started with the Volozhin Yeshiva and Rav Chaim Volozhin. Yeshiva was very successful. Yeshiva achieved its goals. Volozhin produced rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva for four generations, right the way up until Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and to the Netziv. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik married the granddaughter of the Netziv. And it was a institution that taught the students how to think and to create independent scholars. That was the goal of Volozhin. There always were different styles in the yeshiva itself. That was most boldly represented by the two Rosh Yeshivas at the end, the Netziv and Rav Chaim Volozhin. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, his style was Bekias, to get a broad, comprehensive study of Torah. Rav Chaim, on the other hand, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, his style was more he had a new system of learning that he introduced. The way his grandson, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, great-grandson, explained it, is that he said the Balei Musa created a new Shulchan Aruch for behavior, but my grandfather created a new Shulchan Aruch for thinking. His great-grandfather was a new Shulchan Aruch for thinking. So that new approach of Rav Chaim, which was introduced in Volozhin, swept across the yeshiva world like wildfire. And Rav Chaim's approach of Lamdus really became the standard way of learning, of studying Talmud in all of the yeshivas throughout Lithuania. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We are known as the people of the book. We are literary connoisseurs, consumers of words and prose, sharers of ideas. In short, we are readers. Chai FM is starting a book club. We would like you to be one of the Chai FM book club readers. You receive a book every month to review on the radio for our listening community. It's social, it's fun, it's mentally enlightening. We're looking for people with a wide range of reading topics and genres. Get in touch, email books@chaifm.com. We've been discussing Lithuanian Jewry and the great development within Lithuania of yeshivas, which hadn't been done anywhere else in the Jewish world. And the mother of all yeshivas, the Volozhin Yeshiva, opened in 1813 and was a great success and succeeded in educating Jews, leaders of the Jewish people, for four generations. Volozhin, unfortunately, was closed by the Russian government in 1892. So it was in existence for 89 years. That closure was aided by the Maskilim, who saw Volozhin Yeshiva as a major threat. So those were Jewish secularists working against the continuation of Jewish observance. And the reason why it closed was the Russian government, Lithuanian government, made demands that were impossible to be fulfilled by the yeshiva. For example, they only allowed the yeshiva to be open until from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Only a small amount of that time would be allowed for the study of Torah. And so it became impossible to keep the yeshiva open. The other yeshivas, however, with the closing of Volozhin, grew, because by that time there were many yeshivas that had sprouted throughout Lithuania, and they were all founded by students of Volozhin. In 1846, the Mir Yeshiva began in Belarus, which was Belarus, Lithuania. The border often moved. In the 1870s, Slobodka began, Slobodka Yeshiva, which was a suburb of Kovno, which is not far from Vilna. And the great, which was also a great yeshiva, Rav Lazer Gordon opened the yeshiva in Tells. He was the Rav in Tells. So all of these, so what happened was these individuals learned in Voloshin. They became Talmidei Chachamim, independent thinkers and scholars, and they went back to their towns and opened their own yeshivas in the town. So even though Voloshin closed in 1892, Lithuania by then was already filled with yeshivas and successful yeshivas all over the country. And each one of these yeshivas actually developed their own approach and their own particular style based on the Rosh Yeshiva who founded that yeshiva. There wasn't very much polarization between the different yeshivas. It was quite common. There was crossover. Students went to one yeshiva and then ended up going to another yeshiva, which was also very healthy for the development and growth of a student in their Torah learning. And so, for example, Rabbi One talks of his father. His father studied in Grodno. He studied in Slobodka. He studied in Mirkaz Arav of Rav Kook. Later in the yeshiva of Yitzhak Elchanan. So it's common within the Lithuanian yeshiva world to go to different yeshivas and to experience the different places and the different styles. That was unknown in the Jewish world, because in the Polish world, in the world of Hasidus, either you were a Gera Hasid or you were a Snonim Hasid or you were a Balza Hasid, there wasn't much crossover at all. So that was another healthy aspect of the life, of the Jewish life, that was in Lithuania. So we've unfortunately run out of time, but next week, please God, we'll continue with our discussion on the history of Lithuanian Jewry, and we'll discuss the Musa movement, which transformed Lithuanian Jewry and still has a major impact on the Jewish world today. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.